Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How have American women shaped not only their own roles in public and private life, but the very nature of U.S. society? In more than four decades as a journalist, Cokie Roberts has told the stories of some remarkable trailblazing women in politics, and she's helped the news business evolve from one where women were openly informed that their gender put them out of the running for top jobs, to one in which women now anchor several national newscasts and manage some highly influential newsrooms. Currently, Roberts serves as senior news analyst for NPR and as a political commentator for ABC News. She has just published a revised and updated 10th anniversary edition of her New York Times bestseller, We Are Our Mother's Daughters. I am delighted that she could make time to be with us today. Cokie, welcome to Think.
So nice to be with you, Chris.
A lot of people would assume that the last presidential election, where you had two very strong, viable female candidates, is a huge step forward that we can't take two steps back from. Why don't you think that's the case?
Because it was such a sexist campaign. I really couldn't get over it that in the year 2008, it was still apparently acceptable to say things about women that would never be acceptable to be said about minorities, and to ask questions that really I thought had been put to rest, asking Sarah Palin repeatedly and having debates about it, who was going to take care of the children. You know, never in the history of political reporting has a male candidate been asked that question, even a male candidate with two little girls at home. So it depressed me that was the case. And I look at that and I think two things. I think that it might discourage other female candidates, that they take a look at the treatment that Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin got and say, well, who needs it? But also, I think, and probably more important, it discourages men who might be supporting women, because they're ready at the drop of a hat anyway to say, well, we don't want women in this club. And to have an example where women who seem to be doing very well did not, I think, gives them an excuse to say, well, let's not do that again anytime soon.
I wonder if you think any of this is at least in part a factor of the reality that women put more pressure on themselves and on ourselves as working mothers than maybe we put on men.
Well, I do think we do that. And the whole business of mommy wars, you know, just makes me completely crazy.
Are you a good mother if you work, or are you a good mother if you stay home?
Which is just absurd. You know, first of all, it's only a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of American society that has that choice. Most people work because they have to put food on the table and a roof over their heads, whether they're male or female. But secondly, what difference does it make to you what another woman decides? You know, what choice works for you might not work for her. What works for you this year might not work next year. Life is a nonstop balancing act of all kinds of priorities and pressures. So that particular one, I do think pits women against women. But I think by and large, when it comes to things like politics or sports or moving ahead in business or whatever it is, women are very supportive of other women. And Hillary Clinton did get a good deal of support from other women.
I think you mentioned the fact that no one questioned whether Barack Obama's two little girls would be okay if he took on this important job. And the assumption has been, and in fact is the case, that his highly educated wife would not have a job outside of what she did as First Lady. The debate, though, over First Ladies and whether or not they're relevant is fascinating to me, because we've always understood that they're interesting and we've paid attention to what they did. But in a lot of ways, it seems to have kept us from focusing on the fact that they're very political creatures.
Yeah, there's a lot of ignorance about first ladies. And I think some of that has to do with this. There is this kind of American fascination with first ladies. From the beginning, this has been true. And I think it's because people understand that they're very powerful and can't be fired. And so there's kind of a, what is she up to? What is she saying in the privacy of the boudoir? And I think particularly a presidential staff worries about that. But from the beginning, first ladies have been very active. There's this notion that they sat around pouring tea until Eleanor Roosevelt came along, and nothing could be further from the truth. I've now written a couple of big history books about women of the founding period, and Martha Washington, let's start at the beginning. First of all, there were cabinet meetings about what her role should be as First Lady. I mean, this was always very much on the minds of the government from the beginning. And she had been, throughout the 8 long years of the Revolutionary War, had gone to camp every winter with the soldiers at George's behest. There were times when she really kept the Continental Army from defecting. And so after the war, when she became First Lady, there was a lot of discussion in Congress about paying these soldiers the pensions that were due. And, of course, the country was broke and all of that. So she lobbied for Revolutionary War benefits for the veterans that she had been to camp with. And that started a process that has been true ever since, First Ladies being very active and having policy agendas that they spend a lot of time on. The most recent, of course, is Laura Bush. And I have a chapter on her in this new and expanded edition of We Are Mother's Daughters, because her work on women's rights and on human rights really was unsung, I think. And she has been a really fierce First Lady on those subjects.
Did you give a lot of thought to what would have changed if we had a first gentleman in the White House?
Well, it is something we all sort of play with and joke about. And, of course, Bill Clinton would have been an interesting first gentleman. But the I think that we do see now men in roles where the wives are the preeminent person in the partnership. And I think they tend to do good deeds.
Your own mother, Lindy Boggs, spent 18 years in Congress after your father was killed. Can you talk about how she changed and evolved from being a political wife to an elected official herself?
Well, it was a hard transition because in some ways she was more powerful, at least at the beginning, as a political wife, because she had been on the scene for decades and she knew all the players and they all counted on her to do all kinds of things for them. She also, as a political wife, could soothe all of the factions that existed in, particularly in our home state of Louisiana. And she could make everybody kind of think that she was on their side. And then when she ran for Congress herself, my sister, who was a politician, said to her, "You know, Mom, you're just going to hate having to vote because you can't. There's no maybe button, and you're going to have to actually vote yes or no, and somebody's going to be mad at you as a result of that." And that was hard for her, but she quickly came to understand how important it was for a woman to hold real power, not just indirect power. And she saw, because she was in the room where decisions were getting made, how essential it was to have a woman in the room for many of those conversations. And over the years that she was in Congress, she had the same experience that all Congresswomen have, which is that you represent not only the Second District of Louisiana, but the women of America. And that's true for minorities as well. And so she and the other women in Congress got together very explicitly to work on legislation that was of interest to women, children, and families. And that's still true, and particularly true in the Senate. And one of the great practitioners of that is your own Senator Kay Hutchison, who works across party lines on lots of issues that are very beneficial to women.
Well, you know, the maybe button comment is a really interesting one to me, because as a thinking individual, it makes sense to me that very often issues are much closer to maybe than they are to
absolutely.
A yay or nay.
Absolutely. And, you know, as somebody raising children as you are, you see lots of grays. Everything's not black and white. And I think that that's one of the reasons why women work better across party lines than men do, because they're not as ideologically steeped in this, I'm right, you're wrong, this is white, that's black. They do see grays much more.
How do our issues and the things that we consider start to change as more women hold public office?
Well, we have certainly, you certainly see them, as I say, being more conscious about whether it's child care or right now, in fact, today as we speak, there is a move on the part of health insurers to be fairer toward women in an effort to stave off a government health program. That's directly as a result of women in Congress complaining about the discrimination against women by health insurers. So they highlight those kinds of issues. And it's been true now that all kinds of things like breast cancer research or IRAs for non-working mothers, child care for women in public housing. I mean, all kinds of things that women are affected by that you just don't even think of. On the welfare bill, the big welfare bill that was passed during the Clinton administration, it included a section on child support enforcement taking place across state lines. And Republicans were saying, well, this is an infringement on states' rights. But Republican women said, look, it doesn't work to just enforce child support within a state. You know, the guy goes across a line and then the kids starve. And so it was practical experience that caused them to insist on again, having the men in their caucus, at least enough men in their caucus, abandon the ideological position to adopt the practical position to help women who needed to raise their children.
We certainly can't assume, and I know you don't assume, that all the men who were holding all the power before didn't care at all about the welfare of women or children. Did we just make it too easy for them to ignore these things and not recognize them?
I think that it's very easy to have other priorities, and lots of things are important. And, of course, particularly in the period after World War II, when there was a whole new world to shape, and then the Vietnam War, which occupied so much of the activity on Capitol Hill, and then it was things like aid to the Nicaraguan rebels, and all of that was where all the activity was. And so it took women sitting at the table and pulling these issues out from the bottom of the pile and putting them on top to just focus on them. It wasn't that the men didn't care. It's just that they weren't on the top of their priority list. So another good example, mammogram coverage by Medicare. Very difficult to get done because it was off the kind of insurance norm. And yet essential in terms of saving lives and costing a great deal less than treatment. And the men just didn't occur to them. They just, why would it? You know, it takes a woman, in some cases a wife of a member of Congress, but more often a female member of Congress to make that something that they then say, oh, okay, that makes sense to me. I'll go along with that.
Have you ever asked your mother whether she thinks she would have run for office if your father had survived?
She wouldn't have run for office if my father had stayed in Congress. But the question that I kind of find interesting is, would she have run for office as a young person in a different era? And I think the answer to that is definitely yes.
Cokie Roberts is my guest. She is senior news analyst for NPR. Her book, We Are Our Mother's Daughters, has just been re-released in a 10th anniversary edition and revised. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you to get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin this summer. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is senior news analyst for NPR, Cokie Roberts. Her book is called We Are Our Mother's Daughters. It is a revised 10th anniversary edition, and it's just been published. If you'd like to join us, you can send an email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. We have an email here from Carrie who says, the last campaign was extremely difficult for me due to the rampant sexism. However, pretending it wasn't happening was even worse for me. Why do you think the media failed to acknowledge it?
Well, I think the media was some of the culprits. What interested me was how a lot of organized women's groups failed to acknowledge it. And I think that part of the reason for that, or the main reason for that, was just politics. You know, that
they didn't like Sarah Palin.
Or that certainly in that case, but even in the Clinton case, that they were, many of them were more for Obama than for Clinton. But I think that that's why it's important to continue to talk about it, because you can hold people's feet to the fire on things like this. And, you know, there are lots of things where I'm just too exhausted to keep fighting. But on this one, it's worth it to keep fighting, because you can change what people do. You can change your colleagues' behavior. You can make sure that people recognize what they are doing and call them on it. I had a very funny conversation with Nancy Pelosi the other day, who, of course, the Speaker of the House, who talks about how rampant it all still is. And she was saying that she and a group of, she talks about this in her book, she and a couple of other congresswomen used to go regularly to dinner with a group of congressmen. And they were all buddies, and the guys would talk, and they'd never ask the women about anything, and the women would just inject their opinions here and there when they felt like it. But she said one night they were talking about childbirth. The subject turned to childbirth, and the women thought, surely. this will be a time when they will actually ask us what we think. And the women had 11 childbirths among them, and the men never, ever, ever turned to them. And she said, you know, they later called the men on it, and the guy said, oh, that never happened. And she said, of course it happened. They were just clueless. Well, every so often it really does matter to call people on it.
Do you think that need to be sure that you're viewed on an equal playing field is one reason that people perceive Nancy Pelosi in particular as being very strident?
Yes, I do. I think that there she is. It's humorous to me. She's this lovely lady who's the mother of five and the grandmother of another one every day, it seems. And and she's done things like put lactation rooms in the Capitol, right? You know, places where members of Congress and their staffs can privately, cleanly, quietly nurse babies or pump milk. And, you know, this is hardly some radical notion. I guess it is a radical notion in one way. But and I think that because she is leading that caucus and standing up there and being the speaker, literally, the people say, oh, she's not very feminine.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Cokie Roberts. Let's go to Jody in Dallas. Hey, Jody.
Hi. I'm very thrilled to be talking to Cokie Roberts. I've been a big fan for a long time.
Thank you.
You made the comment that there was a lot of sexism in this past election, that people would ask Sarah Palin questions like, who's going to watch the children? I think to some degree Sarah Palin kind of invited that kind of attitude from people, because she stood for the quote-unquote traditional values, and she dragged that baby on stage with her everywhere she went as a prop. So I think she kind of invited that kind of sexist question.
Well, okay. I actually disagree. I think that she actually, from anything that you read that she's said and done, she's actually a feminist. She's pro-life, but she's a feminist. And when she was asked those questions, she basically said, you know, look, we know that someone can be vice president and raise a family. They've done it for years and years and years. They just happen to be men.
I'm 38, and I think to a great extent the reason that I never even gave a thought to my gender when I went to get my first job is due to women in your generation. Can you talk about what it was like for you when you were trying to get your first job?
It was very different, to put it mildly. First of all, I graduated from college in June of 1964, when it was legal to say we don't hire a woman to do that. By July, it was illegal because the 64 Civil Rights Bill was passed, but the certainly employers didn't know that, and they said regularly and with no hesitation, we don't hire women to do that, often with a hand on your knee, because not only was sex discrimination widespread, but sexual harassment was just, you know, a given. And the help wanted ads were male, female, white, colored. So that was the world. Now, a couple of things happened. The law changing was huge, and younger women, I think, have no understanding of that. But the other was that my generation of women was a generation. We were not just singular women, one here, one there, as the women who came before us were. So we came in as a generation of educated women who were eager to do something in the world of work. And so that also knocked down a lot of barriers that you then did not have to face. You and my daughter are exactly the same age, and she has certainly been indoctrinated by her mother and grandmother about all of this. And she certainly still sees a lot of sexism in the workplace. But I think it takes until you're older, till you're about your age, because when you start out, it is pretty equal. It's as you move up that things get a little harder.
I was really fascinated, and I think this may have been one of your previous books, to read that of the something like 78 newspapers in colonial America, 16 of them were edited by women. And there's no comparison to the number that of big newsrooms and newspapers today that are run by women.
Well, that is actually in this book, but it was, you read it in the first edition, but it's still there. And what has changed in the 10 years since I first wrote it is that even though now 66% of the students in journalism schools are female, it's still fractions that are at the top of the editorial process or the production process, et cetera, and in prime newspaper or broadcast spots. So the early days remain still the best, but of course that was in an era when if you owned a printing press, you could run a newspaper.
What do you think, occasionally an academic will come forth and say, sometimes even a feminist academic, and say the reason that women don't ascend to the highest levels in any business is that they have different goals for their lives. Do you think that's true?
I do think we have different goals for our lives, but I think you can still ascend to the highest level with those goals and then use those goals to teach as a teaching tool. And that was one of the very encouraging things I did see in the 10 years difference between when I first wrote this book and then this edition. You have women having made it and really trying to make smooth the path for other women. Women like Billie Jean King succeeding actually in getting the prize money up for other women who play championship tennis, whereas when she was winning world championships, she got about 1/100 of what the men got. And starting a program called Go Girls Go that to get little girls active and involved in athletics. And Sally Ride, who's a physicist as well as an astronaut, doing the same thing in science, trying to get girls involved through something called Sally Ride Science, because we know that girls are great at science till about 8th grade, and then they start losing interest for whatever reason. And women who have made it to the top of business, the messages they give are often very different. So Indra Nooyi, for instance, who is head of Pepsi, and Forbes has dubbed her the third most powerful woman in the world. She calls her mother in India every day. I suspect her predecessor did not call his mother every day. And she says, you know, remember, you are a wife, a mother, a daughter, a sister, a friend. You know, you're a whole person, in other words. That's a very different message from someone whose only goal is to have the business succeed. Now, she also has to have the business succeed and wants, of course, for it to succeed. But she doesn't want people who are working for her to lose a sense of who they are as people. And another person who gave that message, which really impressed me, given her background, was Ruth Simmons, who is the president of Brown University, grew up dirt poor in Grapeland, Texas, where her parents were sharecroppers. They then moved to Houston, where her father went to work in her factory, and her mother took in ironing. And one of the school teachers just understood how smart she was, made sure she got a scholarship to Dillard University in New Orleans, and she has made her way up the academic administrative ladder from one fine institution to the next. But when she was installed as the first female president of Brown, first African-American president of an Ivy League, her message was, a job is a job is a job. A life is something that is too short to waste, to not have a happy one. So I do think that your goals can be goals that where you want to succeed as a whole person, and you want all of your relationships to be valued and good ones, but you can still make it to the top of whatever profession that you choose to make it in.
You include in the book something that you wrote when you were 33, which is so interesting, and that is that the choices that a woman makes are not once and for all. It's sort of a constant and ever-morphing series of decisions, and you have to weigh family and career and aspirations and education. Is that really different from the choices that men make?
Well, I think that men are more likely to make a choice about a job and think that that's their choice. Now, that's changing to some degree because the job situation is such that they're more fluid than they used to be.
Choice for the next 24
right.
months.
Exactly. And I also certainly see young men or younger men taking more responsibility for the family, certainly than men of my generation did, and by leaps and bounds more than men of my father's generation did. My son just... well, my choice of words here I'm having trouble with because I was about to say gave his wife a sabbatical, which is an interesting concept, but suggested to her strongly that she go off for 10 days and finish a book. And he did the you know, stay-home dad routine for the most part. And so everybody now is lauding him as this wonderful person. And he is a wonderful person. And it was a great thing to do. But, of course, she stayed alone with those kids for 10 days, year in and year out, as he has taken business trips. And no one has, you know, felt that a need to send her laurels. So I think that that even though the differences are somewhat greater than they used to be, that still that women are much more in a position of having to make those choices over and over and over again than men are.
Do we gain anything by having
sure.
to continue to examine ourselves?
Sure, sure we do. I think we are, again, people with a more complete life.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Cokie Roberts. Her book is called We Are Our Mother's Daughters. It's just been revised and reissued in a 10th anniversary edition. Let's go next to Ashwini in Dallas. Hi, Ashwini.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank you for getting Cokie Roberts on the show. I love her. I love her message. And I do agree, we are our mother's daughters. My mom told me I could do whatever I could, and that's why I can do what I can.
Oh, thank you.
And it's just so important for women to, push women to do what they can instead of telling them what they cannot do.
Well, thank you for your kind words, and I'm sure your mother is very happy to hear them as well.
Are you worried that younger women are losing that sense of solidarity?
No,
each other.
I worried about it years ago, but I just see way too much of it. And it shows up in all kinds of ways. Book groups, you know, young women use those as almost consciousness-raising sessions. And these wonderful women's giving circles. I was talking earlier today about the Dallas Women's Foundation because I came down a few years ago to do an event with them. And the great work that they do. And now there are, at least the last year I have numbers on it, was 2007, women's giving, more than 400 women's giving circles around the country. And this was a wonderful good news change in the 10 years. We have become greater philanthropists than men, and now by billions of dollars. And we really do give money differently. We do come together as support each other as women, in other words, and pool our resources and then give out our money efficaciously, give it to women and girls who can make good use of it to better the society rather than worrying about our names on buildings or even the tax deduction. And so I see that as another sort of women's support group, not just for the women who are literally being supported, but for women who are part of the giving coming together. No, I think women are still very supportive of each other by and large.
Do you have any empathy for the fact that men in 21st century America are having to redefine their roles themselves?
Sure, I do. I mean, I think it's very hard for them. And I think it's harder for them in a lot of ways than it is for us because we have always been multitaskers. We have always had to do two or three things at once and known that we can't concentrate too much on one thing because there's something else that demands our attention. I think for men that's a harder reality, that they're so used to being focused on the job or the sport or whatever it is. And to be in a world where they have to make changes and adapt constantly, I think is not as easy for them.
Cokie Roberts is my guest. Her book is called We Are Our Mother's Daughters. We'll resume our conversation in a moment, and you're welcome to join us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you to get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin this summer. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is NPR's senior news analyst Cokie Roberts. She's also a political commentator for ABC News. Her book, which has been revised and reissued, is called We Are Our Mother's Daughters. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. Has news changed since women entered newsrooms in such greater numbers?
Yes, there's more health news. There's more news about education. And it's not just women as writers. It's women as readers and viewers and listeners. Mm-hmm. So that those kinds of issues are much more covered than they used to be. But I thought you were heading into has news changed.
We need a whole other hour.
That's
for
right,
that, I think.
Exactly. But and, of course, we have all kinds of changes there. But, yes, it's measurable how having women in the newsroom changes things. But I'm a great believer that what you have to have is diversity of all kinds in a newsroom, not just by sex but by race and by ethnicity and by interest. Because, as you well know, Chris, what happens is in any given day – when the, you know, there's breaking news, and that's easy. Everybody knows what to cover. But lots of days, it's kind of, well, now what are we going to put on the air or put in the paper? And somebody will make a suggestion based on his or her own interest. Mm-hmm. And so it's important to have people with all kinds of interest who are at that table.
Well, and that's a really tough thing, because I think most responsible news directors now are careful to make sure that you have people who come from different ethnic backgrounds and are of different genders, maybe different faiths. But you still have a group of people who are probably, you know, middle class with a certain amount of education, and there's a certain affinity that takes place that maybe is accidental, but shapes the things that we cover.
And absolutely. I remember my husband telling a story once about the head of ABC Radio and CBS Radio getting on the train together in New York to go home to Greenwich. And they were making a joke that they hadn't seen each other in months and months and months. And wasn't this crazy, because Spiro Agnew, who was at that point the vice president, was saying that all these people colluded all the time, and the media was all, you know, of one stripe. And they thought this was a great telling tale about how they hadn't seen each other. And Steve's point was the telling tale was that they were both getting on the train and going back to Greenwich.
Yeah, you know? They had the same life, just
exactly.
Two different houses.
And so you do have to be aware of that. You have to have educated people in the newsroom, people who can write and who have a background. But you do have to try to certainly be listening all of the time to everybody in the society.
Are you as distressed as other people about the next generation and how they don't have a long attention span? There are a lot of assumptions made about millennials that I'm not sure I entirely agree with, but they're out there.
Well, I mean, how long in human history, dear Lord, have people bemoaned the younger generation, right? And I think probably what we're dealing with here now is the baby boomers getting older, and, you know, they were for so long the most dominant force in the society that they can't stand it. And so I think there's a lot of that going on. I bet, looking at your own kids, that you're very encouraged about the younger generation. And I certainly feel that way with my grandkids. They're smart as they come, and they have the attention spans that one would expect of a 7-year-old boy. But I think that there's a lot of gnashing of teeth over people who are younger because they are younger.
What is, like, Sunday brunch like at your house? Are you Grandma Cokie, or what do they call you?
Cokie. They call me Cokie. I had enough, you know, I figured one stupid nickname was enough. Sunday brunch tends to be, unless we're having Sunday dinner, which we often do, have an extended family Sunday dinner where the kids are there, and our mothers are there. Steve and I are blessed with 183 years of mother living nearby. And so we often do take them out to Sunday brunch. My mother's 93 and Steve's mother is 90. And we are very, very lucky to have them. But I must admit, the logistics of getting into Sunday brunch can be quite interesting.
But I wonder if even with the kids there, if the conversation is very political and news oriented.
It is, but a lot of the conversation with the little kids there is asking them to tell the old ladies what they're up to and to engage in conversation with their great grandmothers and to get the great grandmothers to talk more about their past so the children can receive that wisdom. But certainly the table when I was growing up and the table when my children were growing up of just the nuclear family was all politics. And when my brother is over and his grown children, it remains that way. It's a pretty political conversation.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Zika in Dallas. Hi, Zika.
Yes, good afternoon. I wanted to say thank you to Cokie for all her great work.
Well, thank
you. And I wanted to ask her, for young women, especially young moms that are in the workplace today, who may face stereotypes that are used against women, and how do we go about to handle this stereotype that may sometimes affect the way that our job performance is judged, and you know, how do we how do we do a great job without proving those stereotypes wrong and without giving up on advancement? Thank you, and I'll take my answer up there.
Thanks.
Well, I'm not 100% sure what she means, but I would guess that what we're talking about here is men stereotyping women as not being able to do certain jobs or not having the full dedication to the job because of the family. And if there is a woman of power in the place of work or an older woman, I would strongly suggest going and talking to her because often that can be a big help because she can take your case when you feel like you can't take your case. But other than that, often the only answer is to just work really hard. And women do that. And in the end, we do often finally make it just because we've hung on so long and worked so hard. I always joke that, you know, tell girls that all they have to do is work harder and be smarter than the guys, and that's not hard.
You have said that there were times when your work got in the way of your family and times when family got in the way of work.
And that will continue to be true until the day I die, I'm sure.
Yeah, and I'm curious as to how you learn to deconstruct that so that you can at least get a good night's sleep and get ready for the next day of conflict.
Well, look, we're human. We don't deal in perfection, and it's important to keep that in mind. And there are some times when you get the balance right, but just when you think, oh, wow, this is it. You know, I've got everything on an even keel, and I'm swimming along here. Something will happen. You know, someone will get sick or someone will lose a job and need you, or something will happen at work that is just incredibly demanding. And so you just have to not beat yourself up when those things happen and go with it. And that doesn't mean that there aren't times that are just exhausting and guilt-producing. But there are, if you look at it sort of in the long sweep of your life and say, how do I want this to come out in the end? I think the answer is that you've done your best and that you make really sure not to let your relationships suffer, because nobody ever sat on a deathbed and said, I'm sorry, I missed that meeting.
Let's go next to Highland Village, where we find Steve. Hello, Steve.
Hello there. I'm sorry, I came in about half during your dialogue, ladies, and I was kind of curious. It's kind of an ignorant question about, was the comment with regarding to guys not being able to multitask as easily kind of a sweeping generalization or not? Because, admittedly, I'm 39, and my mom had had a few mistakes. She admitted 5 different stepdads I'd had growing up. So I learned from their mistakes. And so I was just kind of curious, you know, were you referring to just the generalization factor or not? So.
Don't take the answer off the air because I want to ask you a question.
Do you feel
like you multitask well?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, well there you go.
I'm dyslexic, ADHD, non-medicated, and not only am I multitasking, talking with you, my headset and the phone as I'm driving, I'm also dealing with a lot of other things floating around in my head. That's the way I grew up.
Uh huh.
Well, do be careful,
Steve. Be careful,
Steve.
Right. These mothers sitting there. You're making us nervous. Well, look, obviously all of these things are vast generalizations, and there are men who are wonderful multitaskers and women who are not. But as a sex, you tend to have, you see more of it with women and less of it with men. And, you know, that wonderful comedy routine of, what is it, becoming a caveman or whatever. He does a great routine about this, that men are focused because, you know, they were hunting and they just had to spend all their time looking at the rear end of the zebra, you know, while women were in the fields having to listen for everything, worrying about what was happening next.
Can you talk for a minute about what made NPR a good place to work at 35 years ago?
Well, first of all, it was brand new. So, when Linda Wertheimer and Susan Stamberg started there as founding mothers, there were nobody else there. You didn't have to shoot the men in order for the women to get the jobs. So that was a big difference from other traditional news organizations. Secondly, not to put too fine a point on it, the pay scale was quite low. It still is. And you could get better women for the money than men. But then what did happen was this core group of women was there, Susan and Linda, and then Nina came a couple of years later, and I came a couple of years after that. And we became fast friends and incredibly supportive of each other, and then started bringing along other women. But it was very conscious.
Let's go next to Nolanda in Fort Worth. Hey, Nolanda.
Hi there. Hi, Cokie.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing okay. I wondered, my son, who was 31, he died recently, grew up in Highland Park, Texas, and he was about the only one in his class. He had a working mother and a very hardworking mother. And I became aware recently of what an impact that made when I found, going through his stuff on his desk, a little letter opener he had made that said, "Happy Working Mother's Day." And he was probably about 7 years old. You have much experience in the same general time frame because we're the same age, and you know my background. So tell me how it affected your son within their classmates and their peers to have a mother who worked so hard in an affluent community.
Well, first, I want to offer you my condolences. It must be very, very, very difficult for you to have lost a son at such a young age, and I'm terribly sorry. My son, I have one son and one daughter, and I think by and large it was fine. But you're right. When they were little kids, they were at public school in the neighborhood, and a lot of the moms didn't work, and it did make me crazy because they kept scheduling things that assumed that we were all going to be able to show up at, 11 o'clock in the morning.
They still do that.
It's just nuts. And worse, they would do things like send the children home early because it was snowing, and it was so dangerous, those were tough years in there at various times. But I don't think the kids had any resentment of it. In fact, they now claim they don't, and they're kind of, my daughter particularly, feels insulted at the question because, she's perfect, and why would anybody question this? And of course, she's a working mom herself. But I know there were times when they sure wished dinner were earlier, and when I was covering Congress daily and having to file for All Things Considered and then file again for Morning Edition, it got to be late. And they revealed many years later that they often had dinner at some friend's house at 6 and then dinner at our house again at 9. And they were nice enough to say that our dinner was better because I did cook always. But I think that got on their nerves. And what they told me years later, what really annoyed them, was that we would call, and Steve and I were both covering Congress at this point, we would call and say, "All right, we'll be home at 7. And then we'd call again and say, "Whoops, we won't be home till 7:30, 8, 8, and that they felt was not courteous, that we were not being respectful of their time. And I think that's a very fair criticism. But by and large, they didn't seem to have many complaints, and they're wonderful grown-ups.
Cokie Roberts is senior news analyst for NPR and a political commentator for ABC News. She has just published a revised and updated 10th anniversary edition of her best-selling book, We Are Our Mother's Daughters. Cokie, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Chris. What a treat to be with you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.